This part of the Scott Horton Show is sponsored by Audible.com. And right now, if you go to audibletrial.com/Scott Horton Show, you can get your first audiobook for free. Of course, I'm recommending Michael Swanson's book, The War State, The Cold War Origins of the Military-Industrial Complex and the Power Elite. Maybe you've already bought The War State in paperback, but you just can't find the time to read it. Well, now you can listen while you're out marching around. Get the free audiobook of The War State by Michael Swanson, produced by Listen and Think Audio, at audibletrial.com/Scott Horton Show. All right, y'all, Scott Horton Show. Check out the archives at scotthorton.org and at libertarianinstitute.org/Scott Horton Show. And by the way, I keep forgetting to say, I'm going to be, me and Sheldon and Jerry LaBelle are going to be at the Students for Liberty thing February 17th through 19th in Washington. So if you guys want to come out to that, we'll see you there. All right, cool. Introducing Daniel Lazare. Writing again for consortiumnews.com. This one is called How Obama Spread the Mideast Fires. Welcome back to the show. How are you?
I'm fine, Scott. How are you?
I'm doing pretty good. Appreciate you joining us today. So great article. Great little rehash for Obama's legacy. Legacies are so important to presidents. This guy, he'll go down in history as what to you, Daniel?
I don't know. I think he's the president who wasn't there. I mean, he has this eerily detached manner. He's a very cool guy, very calm, very likable, but somehow he just sort of presided over a growing disaster, especially in the Middle East.
So here's the thing of it. I was talking about this. Well, we talk about this all the time, but got into it with Ronnie Akolik the other day. About, you know, really, and this comes up all the time. It's what Seymour Hersh called the redirection, or maybe he was quoting somebody else. But basically, right around 2006, 2005 even, Zalmay Khalilzad and others in the government started realizing that, oops, we just basically invaded Iraq for Iran. And now we need to make up for that with this Sunni turn and tilt back toward the Saudis. And then in that case, it meant from the very beginning, really, backing bin Ladenite types in Lebanon, in Syria, and in Iran from the very beginning. And so Obama inherited this policy, but instead of saying, well, wait a minute, that's crazy, he just doubled and tripled and quadrupled the damn thing, where it even ended up culminating in the Islamic State, which still exists, by the way, after a year and a half of war against it as a actual place, not just a name of a terrorist group, but an actual place on the map. The border between Iraq and Syria has not been redrawn at this point at all. That's still their territory, right?
Yeah.
Crazy thing. What explains that? Because he doesn't want to go down in history as the president who backed Zawahiri's men, does he, or does he?
Well, I don't know. He's a very hard guy to lead. I think what explains it is that the invasion of Iraq and other events sort of triggered a massive slide in Middle East politics, and that the Arab Spring in 2011, was kind of a very mixed bag. It was some ways very hopeful breakthrough, but in other ways a continuation and even acceleration of that slide. And Obama responded to it really in the worst way possible. He did it by backing a counter-revolution that originated in the Persian Gulf. And this was a revolution intent on rolling back democracy and substituting in its place a kind of a stifling Saudi-style Sunni orthodoxy. So Hillary Clinton, with Obama's backing, persuaded the Qatar, for example, to join in the effort to overthrow Gaddafi in Libya in March 2011. And Qatar was quite happy to get on board because as soon as it was on board, it took $400 million, which is a lot of money to you and me, but pocket change for the emir of Qatar, and spread it out among Salafist rebel groups who proceeded to destroy the country and do to it what equivalent forces have done to Afghanistan of the 1980s. So Libya was a disaster area within months. And then, to make things even worse, when the civil war broke out in Syria, Hillary convened a, quote, Friends of Syria conference in Istanbul, in which Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and the United Arab Emirates agreed to donate hundreds of millions of dollars to anti-Assad rebels in Syria, who turned out to be exactly the same types, Sunni, Salafist, fanatical, fundamentalist warriors, who set about chopping off heads and terrorizing especially the minority population of Syria. So that country was destroyed as well. So Obama has presided over the destruction of two Middle East countries. He then backed Saudi Arabia's war on Yemen, which is quickly reducing a third country to ruin. He has sent drone bombers to other places as well. I can't even remember how many. And so the result we have is a disaster area stretching from North Africa across the Middle East, one that is, you know, seen as civil war, religious sectarianism, spiraling violence, and a tidal wave of refugees descending on Europe who are, overturning politics from Warsaw to Washington. It's a first-class disaster, and it really, really is entirely at Obama's feet.
We know that he knows better, but he does it anyway. He tells Tom Friedman, look, there's no moderates to back over there, but then he backs them. Yeah. And so he ends up, he's back in the al-Nusra front. And, you know, we know that even the New York Times, especially the Washington Times, but the New York Times even conceded, it's in all the emails, that certainly Hillary Clinton, and he must have known, that he was backing the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group in Libya, and that these guys were the veterans of Iraq War II. They were Zarqawi's guys in Iraq War II. He had to have known better, and he did it anyway. It's not, none of us believe that. For whatever reason, maybe we should, but I don't think any of us believe that this is what he really wanted to do. It's all just the history of all the horrible things everybody else wanted him to do that he knew better than to do, but then he did them.
I mean, so, as I said, the psychology is really hard to figure out. I mean, it's hard not to respond to this guy in a really personal way. I mean, you and I went to high school with guys like Obama. He's a really cool guy, and the kind of cool guy who adapts effortlessly to whatever institution he finds himself in, whether it's the Illinois State Legislature, the Harvard Law Review, or the White House. But you know what? He's just too cool. He just adapts too effortlessly, and consequently, he doesn't rock the boat. He just seems to be to go along. He seems to be all too unflappable, and as a result, he just doesn't change things. And he therefore put up with a lot of nonsense. But you know, also, but his values are very strange too. For example, after Qatar agreed to join the anti-Gaddafi effort in Libya, he welcomed Emir al-Thani to the White House in April 2011, where he expressed appreciation for, quote, the leadership the emir has shown when it comes to democracy in the Middle East. Well, Qatar is an absolute dictatorship. I mean, the Qatar has shown no leadership whatsoever. So what was Obama thinking? What was he saying? Was he stoned out of his mind? Was he merely being cynical? Obama's own State Department has branded him as a lawless autocrat who represses freedom of speech, freedom of the press, freedom of assembly, et cetera, and even countenances human trafficking for domestic workers and other kinds of workers. But Obama just disregarded that and described the guy as a great Democrat. So was he fooling us? Was he fooling himself or what?
Yeah. And well, democracy just means country that does what America says.
I'm sorry.
Huh? Oh, I'm sorry.
What was that, please?
Oh, well, democracy just means a country that does whatever America says. So in that sense,
yeah.
You know, of course he's a champion of democracy. That's what makes Obama the leader of the free world, is that the Qataris and the Bahrainis are under our thumb.
But it's one thing, but you and I know that's ridiculous, but does Obama believe his own lies?
Gotta wonder.
Really,
well, and speaking of which, all right, now, Dan, I want to play for you this clip. And I'm sorry, because I may have put you through this before, but I like it, and it's instructive, I think, for people. It's the very end of February 2012. Hillary Clinton's still the Secretary of State, and she is being questioned by CBS News. And the frame of the question, of course, is why aren't we doing more to help the rebels in Syria? And so she's basically excusing Obama's reluctance to do more, which we know that she was always pushing for more at this point, as you already said. But anyway, so here was her defense of Obama's position to CBS News then. This is February, I believe, the 28th of 2012.
We know al-Qaeda, Zawahiri, is supporting the opposition in Syria. Are we supporting al-Qaeda in Syria? Hamas is now supporting the opposition. Are we supporting Hamas in Syria? So I think, Wyatt, you know, despite the great pleas that we hear from those people who are being ruthlessly assaulted by Assad, if you're a military planner or if you're a secretary of state and you're trying to figure out, do you have the elements of an opposition that is actually viable, we don't see that.
So there you go. Yeah, speaking of knowing better. All right, so, I mean, what do you make of that? There's Hillary. She spent, as you just said, the whole rest of the year trying to come up with these Friends of Syria plans. And pushing, as she even bragged later, that she, Petraeus, and Panetta, they all wanted Obama to do so much more, and he was reluctant and would only do so much, when she just made the perfect case that this is what Ayman al-Zawahiri wants. I mean, you couldn't put it worse than that, could you?
Well, what Hillary did was she sort of performed a kind of a rhetorical trick. She then announced that the way to outflank al-Qaeda was by supporting the moderate rebels and allowing them to take the lead, so that essentially the extremists would be shut out of the battle. That was the stated logic, the strategy that that she and Obama put across. It just never made any sense, because what happened is that the Free Syrian Army, the so-called moderates, very quickly joined in a tacit alliance with al-Qaeda, and to the point of sharing weapons and stuff. So whatever aid the U.S. Gave them wound up very quickly in the hands of al-Qaeda. So whereas the U.S. Claimed to be outflanking al-Qaeda, it was really joining forces with al-Qaeda.
Right. Oh, I know. Yeah, let's talk about what you wrote here about Palestine. All right, so okay. Now, Daniel, the other thing is, and this is the thing that always happens, is that the president, whether it's Bush Sr. or Clinton or Obama, Bush Jr. or Obama, they all go, oh, yeah, we're going to try real hard, see if we can get a two-state solution for a minute here and have a peace process. And then, yeah, not so much, you know, I guess not. Bill Clinton did it. Usually they seem to wait till the last year or two of the presidency. I guess with Obama, they tried at the very beginning of the second term for just a minute. And then, you know, Mr. Could-have-been president, John Kerry, the current Secretary of State, he gave this big speech saying, man, if only Israel would do what I say, kind of a thing the other day. What do you make of it all?
I didn't make very much of it. And I'm kind of appalled by the liberal reaction, which is very pro-Kerry. And everyone's very happy to see Kerry finally beating up on Benjamin Netanyahu, the Israeli hardline prime minister. But first of all, as you point out, he waits until his last few weeks in office when it doesn't really matter anymore. And number two, there was a very important subtext to that talk that was largely overlooked. Kerry said quite clearly The reason he wants to have peace between Israel and Palestine is in order to hammer out a regional alliance involving Egypt, Jordan, and the six Gulf Cooperation Councils countries, which are Saudi Arabia, Qatar, Kuwait, the United Arab Republic, United Arab Emirates, Oman, and Bahrain. And to wield them into an alliance against Iran. So therefore, you know, he wants peace in one corner of the Middle East, so he'll have a freer hand to engage in various imperial misadventures in another part of the Middle East, in the Persian Gulf, which is really what the U.S. only cares about.
When he's the guy that just negotiated the nuclear deal and took the largest outstanding issue between our country and theirs off the table, the threat of their civilian nuclear program becoming a nuclear weapons program. He's the guy.
Yes.
That counts for nothing? Or that's why he's got to be even more horrible on every other thing.
Yes. In a nutshell, yes, that's exactly it. So I mean, so it, you know, the whole thing is so incoherent. So he makes a gesture towards Iran, and a very important gesture, but he's got to follow that up with renewed assurances to Saudi Arabia, which is, by the way, that's why Saudi Arabia launched its air war against Yemen in March 2015, and why the U.S. felt obliged to get on board because it wanted to assure the Saudis that it was still on their side despite the peace arrangements with Iran.
You know what? So, Let me ask you more about that, because I was just interviewed on another radio show this morning, and that's exactly what I told them. Why are we doing this to Yemen? Well, it's to placate the Saudis, is what the Obama people told the New York Times. Well, we want to make them feel a little better about themselves after the nuclear deal. But then I'm thinking, man, 2 years of air war, there's got to be more going on here. I mean, for whatever reason, I guess the National Security Council has decided whether the Saudis agree or not, right? That it's intolerable that the Houthis rule Sana. Is that it?
Well, I think it's I think what it's about is about oil. I mean, the Persian Gulf contains 54% of the world's fossil fuel supplies. That is an immense prize. And even though the price of oil has fallen 50% over the last year and a half, the U.S. has invested literally trillions of dollars in militarizing the Gulf, and it's not going to walk away from that investment. So whatever it takes to protect that investment, it will do. And if that means sacrificing the life of 10,000 Yemenis, then, you know, that's their problem.
In other words, you're not saying because, oh, boo-hoo, the Houthis threatened to, you know, the gates of the Red Sea or anything like that. You're just saying because the Saudis want to, and we have to keep them happy.
Basically, yes. I mean, like, no, listen, the Red Sea itself is a very important trade corridor. So I guess the U.S. is a little bit worried about a hostile force backed by Iran, you know, gaining a chokehold on this trade corridor. But the real reason, I mean, the ultimate reason is oil, 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 oil. And this, then the Persian Gulf has been the focus of U.S. foreign policy since World War II. There has the administration, the Washington has been amazingly consistent on this point. It has invested $7 trillion in the estimate of one Princeton University economist, and it's just not going to walk away from that investment. So it will do whatever it can to protect it. And as I said, if that means sacrificing 10,000 Yemeni lives, then that's just, you know, that's their problem. Yeah. It's monstrous. I mean, I'm not trying to excuse it one bit. I mean, it's horrible. I mean, I've seen pictures of the wounded and dead children, and it's just absolutely monstrous. But that's what the U.S. is doing.
Yeah, man. All right. So now, tell me about just what kind of kook you think Recep Erdogan is, because here's a guy who took a policy that said no trouble with our neighbors ever and changed it into let's back a bunch of bin Ladenites against Assad, which, you know, not bragging or whatever, but just context, you know, it was discussed in agreed on this show that without a NATO-style air war, Assad isn't going anywhere. He represents a coalition that would prefer him to jihadists any day, no matter how bad he is, and that that's, you know, that kind of status quo is more or less going to hold. He's not going to lose Damascus to bin Ladenites. And yet, Erdogan wasn't that smart, and for that matter, Obama just absolutely went along, no problem with letting Erdogan back al-Nusra and even the Islamic State. I mean, Phil Giraldi told me he was in Turkey and he saw guys raising money for the Islamic State on the streets there, you know. So that semi-permeable membrane of there, the Turkish border with Syria, where jihadis for years were crossing there, coming from all over the Middle East and all of that. What is the point of that? And how well did it work out for Turkish policy compared to what Erdogan was trying to accomplish there, Daniel?
Oh, it's been a disaster, an absolute disaster. Turkey is in desperate straits. That society is falling apart before our very eyes. Erdogan, you may recall, actually was sort of slow to get on board the anti-Assad bandwagon. When the U.S., France, and Britain called for Assad's overthrow in, I believe, August 2011, Erdogan actually held back. But eventually he succumbed to U.S. pressure, not only to U.S. pressure, but also it was widely thought that that Assad would go, that he would follow in Gaddafi's footsteps in Libya, and that yet another Middle East government would fall, and the U.S. would be able to put in an obedient, docile regime in its place. Erdogan went along with that, and also Erdogan, being a mild Islamist, felt a deep ideological kinship with the Syrian opposition, which was dominated by the Muslim Brotherhood. So Erdogan figured, you know, I can't lose. I mean, Assad will go. I'll get a kindred government in Damascus. The U.S. will be grateful for all my efforts. My status will rise at home. My own mild Islamism will be ever more successful, and I'll be elected president for life. What could go wrong? Well, in fact, everything has gone wrong. Assad didn't go. The anti-Assad rebel movement turned out to be run by al-Qaeda and ISIS. They established cells throughout Turkey. They were then furious when Turkey turned against them and formed an alliance with Russia, their main enemy. And now they're taking their vengeance. Bombs are going off all across Turkey. The society is splintering very rapidly, and democracy seems to be nearing a termination point.
Yeah, and so, yeah, there's been more and more terrorist attacks there. He's really picked a fight with the PKK as well as with the jihadists, as you mentioned there. And he has how many forces now? I've lost track of this part of the story. There's so many facets to it, Daniel, that there are Turkish forces that are in Syria right now, I guess, fighting al-Nusra, or at least in the name of fighting al-Nusra, but really guaranteeing that the Kurds, that the YPG, Syrian Kurdish forces, stay east of the Euphrates. And are they fighting them at this moment? And by the way, these are the same Kurdish groups that America and Russia are both backing against the Islamic State right now.
Are they fighting them at this moment? I'm not sure they really are, but this the Syrian incursion is working out very badly as well for Erdogan. It's yet another problem he faces. It started off gloriously, but the Russians made it clear to him that he could not use air power. He could not bomb Syria at will, or he would face the wrath of the Russian air force. So he's had to send troops in unprotected by air power. And consequently, they're bogged down. They're having a very difficult time fighting ISIS. They've lost significant – they've experienced significant casualties. And that can't be going well with the people back home. Meanwhile, he's facing a major Kurdish insurgency inside Turkey itself, And he is facing the ultimate prospect of the YPG essentially consolidating its forces so that it would establish an autonomous zone all along the hundreds of miles of a Syrian-Turkish border. So one can almost feel sorry for Erdogan. He faces all the troubles of Job. His policies have collapsed in a really spectacular way, and there's no way out for the guy. He's painted himself into a corner. The Turkish Republic is much more unstable than people realize. But then again, you know, the U.S. Republic is much more unstable than people realized. And so so the U.S. itself is heading towards a crunch as Donald Trump prepares to take office, and the CIA seems to be doing everything in its power to stop him from entering the White House.
Yeah. Well, wow, you're going to go that far? Go ahead. And I mean, are they really trying to stop him from being inaugurated at this point, do you think?
I think it's absolutely extraordinary. They're pulling out all stops.
It's pretty amazing.
Why did Clapper show him this 35-page dossier alleging that he was cavorting with prostitutes?
And vouch for the source to CNN and say, we don't know about the facts, but we like the guy that wrote it.
Precisely. And so why did he do it? How was he expecting Trump to respond?
This is a big question. I mean, what's he going to do about it? I think he's either got to crush them or they're going to own his ass the same way they've owned Obama this whole time.
I think it's absolutely correct. I think it's absolutely extraordinary. I mean, this is a country which has prided itself on its peaceful transfer of power every 4 years. I mean, you know, other countries, you know, banana republics have coup d'etats and stuff, but not the United States. Every inauguration day, you know, one president takes office, another one rides off into the sunset, and it's all peaceful and legalistic. But that was a long time ago. Now suddenly we have an intelligence establishment which is actually in open warfare against the president-elect. And you have a president-elect denouncing the intelligence community as Nazis.
Well, and they don't really have a plan. I mean, it's not like Obama's going to try to stay in office or anything like that. He knows better. He has no ambition to do that.
No,
what are they going to do? Put Petraeus in there?
So what was Clapper expecting when he showed him this 35-page dossier or the 2-page summary? Did he expect Trump to break down in tears and admit it was all true? And then when Clapper put his hand on Trump's shoulder and said, you know, in a gentle but comforting, you know, tones, but firm tones, you know, it's time to step down, Donald, and allow Mike Pence to take over. I mean, we don't know what's going on, but something really weird is going on behind the scenes. That is clear at this point.
Yeah. Well, you know, the thing is about Donald Trump, he's the only guy in the whole country who is not a vice president, a senator, or a governor who could have possibly won the nomination and then the presidency. And it's only because he is rich enough and bold enough, brash enough that, you know, willing to tangle. And he got straight up there and stomped Jeb Bush into the ground in the most impolite and impolitic way that you're not supposed to do things. And he didn't give a damn. He went up there and crushed him. And you come at the king, you better not miss, right? And here they've clearly pissed him off. And he's just sitting in his tower biding his time until he actually takes the oath and gets in the chair. But then what? I don't know. I don't mean to be too optimistic. My longtime prediction has always been that he would tell them, you guys do whatever you want, dude. You don't have to fight with me. But I don't know.
I don't think even Trump knows what he'll do. But listen, Trump is a right-wing idiot, authoritarian, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But he's also the most radical president since William Jennings Bryan or Henry A. Wallace in 1948, if they had won the presidency. But they didn't, and he did. Now, so as a result, the military foreign policy intelligence complex is in a panic because Trump wants to switch sides in this great arc, you know, zone of conflict from Syria through Eastern Europe. And they don't know what to do. They are in a first-class panic.
Well,
and
didn't it seem like, I mean, it seems to me the obvious compromise that he's making with them, though, is you still get to have special forces and CIA drone wars and terror wars from Morocco to the Philippines. We're just not going to overthrow the nation states, and we're not going to pick a fight with Russia. But he has, you know, he's endorsed their plan for $1 trillion or two worth of new nukes and all of that.
But they want a showdown with Russia as their focus.
Yeah,
and you know, from Estonia to Syria, and he's saying no. This is very radical. It really is, and they're in a tizzy.
Yeah, yeah, it's really an amazing thing, and especially it's sort of just the side punchline is watching all the liberals line up with the CIA and the deep state and denounce Trump above all for daring to push back against the claims of the American intelligence establishment. I mean, that is just a barrel of monkeys.
It's even worse. I mean, the Guardian has run an article by its New York correspondent Ed Pilkington, urging the CIA to continue probing the Steele dossier regardless of what Trump tells them. If it finds anything, to go to Congress and therefore initiate impeachment proceedings. So essentially, the Guardian is calling for the intelligence agencies to take covert action to depose a sitting U.S. president. I think this is a big, big deal.
Well, and check out this one, too. I'm sure you saw it's in the Ynet News and now in Haaretz as well, that American spies, presumably CIA, told the Mossad, don't leak to us, don't talk to us, don't share classified material with us that we're going to have to share with the president because he might leak it to Russia and Iran, which, I mean, are these people kidding me or what? I can see it now where he just brings an army division home from Germany and marches them to Langley. You guys are fired, all of you. Beat it. Go get a job. You're done. I mean, they're crazy. Either they're going to shoot him in the face or he's going to shoot them in the face. One or the other. It's really coming down to it now, it seems like.
Deep instability is looming. It's really an amazing moment in history. The American structure is coming undone.
Yeah. And with Donald Trump as the guy of all people to be the one taking even this shadow, this most palest imitation of a Ron Paulian position is enough to put them at full DEFCON 1.
Did you ever see the movie 7 Days in May?
Yeah.
Oh, well, it's a great movie, but I mean,
hey, JFK let them film it in the White House because it was a concern of his.
Right, but they hear the president in question in the movie is for your listeners who don't know, it was a movie made in 1964, I believe. It was about a military plot to overthrow the elected government. But the president in the story, the fictional president, was an earnest liberal. Mm. But now we have the same story unfolding, but it's a madman right winger who's playing the role.
And who is no Ron Paulian at all. I mean, who's really, you know, kind of a right wing Jacksonian and a nationalist and a militarist, I mean, for that matter. I mean, again, he said, you can have your terror war. You can have all the terror war you want, man. You can invade every country in Africa, which you're so calm for all I care. Is basically his position so far. We're just not going to overthrow the secular dictators for a little while. That's not good enough for them, Jesus. Anyway, I'm sorry. I'm running so late here. Thank you so much for coming back on the show, Dan. I love talking with you and reading you.
Talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
All right, y'all, that is Daniel Lazar, and I'm so sorry I've been saying your name wrong this whole time, too. Daniel Lazar, you can find him all the time over there now at consortiumnews.com. How Obama Spread the Mideast Fires, consortiumnews.com. And check out the archives, scotthorton.org, more than 4,300-something-or-other interviews there, going back to 2003 now at scotthorton.org, and find all the latest stuff, too. at libertarianinstitute.org/Scott Horton Show. I'm on Twitter at Scott Horton Show as well. See ya.
Hey, Al Scott here. If you've got a band, a business, a cause, or campaign, and you need stickers to help promote, check out thebumpersticker.com at thebumpersticker.com. They digitally print with solvent ink, so you get the photo quality results of digital with the strength and durability of old-style screen printing. I'm sure glad I sold thebumpersticker.com to Rick back when. He's made a hell of a great company out of it, and there are thousands of satisfied customers who agree with me, too. Let thebumpersticker.com help you get the word out. That's thebumpersticker.com at thebumpersticker.com. You hate government? One of them libertarian types? Or maybe you just can't stand the president, gun grabbers, or warmongers? Me too. That's why I invented LibertyStickers.com. Well, Rick owns it now, and I didn't make up all of them, but still, if you're driving around and want to tell everyone else how wrong their politics are, there's only one place to go. LibertyStickers.com has got your bumper covered. Left, right, libertarian, empire, police state, founders quote, central banking. Yes, bumper stickers about central banking. Lots of them. And, well, everything that matters. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck.